You are listening to the Wesley Seminary Podcast out of Wesley Seminary at Iwu. Your host today is Dr. Aaron Perry, Assistant Professor of Pastoral Care.
Race is a distortion. God made us for relationship. Those are the words of today's guest, Dr. Brian Bantam. He's a professor of theology at Seattle Pacific University and the author most recently of The Death of Race, Building a New Christianity in a Racial World. In today's podcast, you'll hear Dr. Bantam tell some of his own story of being of African-American descent, but having a mother who is white and a dad who is African-American, and how that formed part of his own story. You're going to hear us talk about the ways that we can engage Scripture and others in an opportunity to understand not only our own stories, but the stories of others. And you're going to see a little bit of reflection from a theologian on what it means to live in opposition with one another, but also how what it means to live in harmony with one another. I hope that you'll enjoy today's podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Brian, you write this in the introduction. This book is an offering, a prayer. It's the sketch of a new shelf that might fit our space, our moment. I'm not building from nothing. I'm breaking boards and prying out old nails, cutting and sanding from the shelves and chairs and tables of saints that have walked before. That little snippet is kind of the culmination of you telling the story of how building shelves at the end of the school year provides this metaphor for you writing this book on race. Can you kind of flesh that out for us a little bit? How did this act of building shelves become for you this act of offering a prayer in writing this book?
Yeah. The practice of building bookshelves started when I was in grad school and, you know, working with ideas that are very ephemeral and hard to touch. I was really just craving something that I could actually put my hands to. And I needed something very practical to put books on, being a poor grad student. And so I started learning how to build bookshelves, and we had this really beautiful blank 10-foot space, 10-foot high by 10-foot wide space, blank wall. I was like, oh, the built-in bookshelves would be amazing there. We just bought a new house, and so I went ahead to try to make them. And it just became this kind of project of figuring out how to work with space. And the first mistake that I made, among many, was realizing that the spaces are always going to be a little different based on where they are in the wall, that every wall in a house is actually not straight, and that every corner actually isn't 90 degrees, and every shelf itself, every plank of wood is slightly different in its thickness. And so one of the things I started to learn was that you had to basically customize pieces to every section along the way. And this became a really important turning point for me, because I realized, I mean, especially where I went to grad school, we were always kind of searching for that next best idea that would somehow solve the problems of modernity or solve racism. And so, you know, maybe it was a better way of thinking about Eucharist, or maybe it was a better way of thinking about prayer. Maybe if we retrieved this early church theologian. But, you know, the ideas were all fine, right? And I could have an idea of a bookshelf, but at the end of the day, theology had to work with material things, and it had to work inside of spaces that it couldn't always determine. And I think in a lot of ways, what this book is an attempt to kind of say, what does it mean for kind of everyday Christians to think about questions of race, questions of embodiment, that as we've kind of gone through all these kind of really contentious questions of race, what's been clear to me is that we don't really actually have an account of our bodies, of the materiality of our lives, that we're kind of using this old story about who we were. And it just doesn't address the questions that are facing us right now. So in some ways, Death of Race is my attempt to kind of build something new, to offer a kind of a theology that has a kind of body, a kind of materiality to it, that might offer maybe a different way of telling the story that might help to make our kind of current moment make a little bit more sense, and maybe offer a certain way forward.
Let me ask you this question from two poles. Let's say you've got the person who feels like they are inundated with conversations about race. How would you answer them if they were to ask, why do we need another book on race? How would you answer that person who feels like swamped in it?
Yeah. Well, I think I mean, I think they can't really have too many because part of it is to say that race is a very complicated issue. And it's not only complicated, but it's multifaceted. And every particular person has a particular way of addressing it. And I think in many ways, we need all the books because just to help us, help us resist the temptation to gloss over it as an issue, like, I just need to be nicer to people. Whereas for this book, though, I think the niche that it fits and what it's doing a little bit differently is that it's really trying to offer, it's less a book about race, as it is a systematic theology that accounts for race. And so my really attempt is to say, what does it mean to kind of go back to the stories of how we were made in the image of God, and take those stories seriously as though something like race or gender matters? How do we tell the story of what went wrong, of what the fall is, and how do we account for social and structural sin in the midst of that? If we talk about the image of God and we talk about the fall, then how does that change how we think about who Jesus is and what salvation looks like? So my hope really is that it's in addition to what those other books offer, but it's really a book that after you've done reading it, you can't quite preach the same way. You can't quite, do your Bible studies the right way, that you kind of go back to scripture with a theological framework or a theological lens that lets you see the bodies and account for difference in ways that I hope are faithful.
Let me shift to the other side of the pole, and a person who never has a conversation on race, and it's not an issue in their community because they never see it, right? Maybe it's an underlying issue, but it's one that they don't even know is being talked about. They just never talk about it. What would you say to that person about why they should read a book on race and think about this important topic?
Well, I think in some ways, like this is the systematic part is part of the entry point to say that everybody has a story about their beginnings, right? We have all these kinds of stories about what went wrong. And I can understand that. Like I came to Christ when I was 16. The church had a basic kind of sense of like color blindness and we're all the same and we don't really, let's not think about all those justice things. And so I totally understand that. At the same time, as I started to grow in my faith, I started to get confronted by these problems, and people who were naming problems and people who loved me and who I loved. And if I was going to love them well, I had to account for these parts of their life that they were trying to name. And so I think when we think about this, anybody in discipleship, you don't get to decide the parts of your life that you want to grow in or not grow in, right? We come out of the baptismal waters and we don't instantly know everything that there is to confess. It's discipleship is actually a process of learning what ought to be confessed. And then learning what that confession means to live into holiness, to live into faithfulness in some sort of way. So I think if you've never had a conversation about race, never been encountered by it, you've nonetheless seen some sort of been encountered by some sort of difference in your community, whether it's gender, whether it's sexuality, whether it's race, whether it's immigration. And it might feel strange initially, but I think part of the power of the Christian life is that we are encountered by differences. That to follow Jesus is to follow him into the lives of people who are different than us, who are strange, whose identities almost oftentimes conflict with ours. And what that means is that we have to rethink who we are in light of these people that God brings into our lives, whether it's through media, whether it's through a neighborhood.
So you've described a little bit about how you've gone about describing the story of race by delving into some of the stories of scripture, and you engage with Adam and Eve, you engage the story of Mary, you engage the story of Jesus, of course. But you've done this in a way that tells your own story as well. So whenever I was going through the book, there was a couple times where I was like, I'm not quite sure I understand what Brian is saying, but I at least know that I'm not understanding, right? I at least know there's somebody here who's articulating something that makes sense to them and that is part of who they are and want me to know, which itself is such an important realization, mm-hmm. right? That there's somebody who's telling a story here that is about them, that matters to them, that is about their intersection with the gospel that I don't quite know. And out of that not knowing, then I can grow. And then I can build on that. So I want to kind of go into a little bit of you telling your own story in this book. Early on, you describe being at a financial institution of some sort and being forced to choose on the box, choosing either white or black. And at 5 or 6 years old, you chose white. And of course, you said that didn't really have any meaning to you because you weren't aware of what story was being written on your body and through your body. Mm-hmm. A couple pages later, you have this phrase. You say, when I was 16, I became a Christian. When I was 19, I became black. Can you tell us what's that mean?
Yeah, well, I think that part of it is like, so growing up in my house, my father, who was black, didn't really talk a lot about what it meant to be black. And my kind of physical features are such that it's kind of ambiguous to some, maybe clearer to others. And so in a lot of ways, I kind of grew up somewhat disconnected from the African-American community. And because of this, I grew up in a house with my white mom and my white aunts and didn't realize it, but I was very much imbibing certain notions of whiteness without even realizing it. And by whiteness, I'm thinking of kind of certain notions of self-sufficiency, of independence, of kind of pull yourself up by your own bootstraps kind of mentalities. And then, you know, frankly, certain kind of prejudicial views towards other folks. And
that if they weren't able to do that, there was something wrong with them.
Right.
If they weren't able to live out the values of self-sufficiency and pulling themselves up, that, well, there's got to be a way to explain that.
Right. Yeah. Which is, of course, ironic because my mom spent a good amount of our childhood on food stamps and she had incredible support from her family in order to. So part of it is like kind of the. It doesn't actually make sense when you come down to it, but there's a certain mentality that's there. But when I was 19, I mean, all through my teenage years, there's always that kind of question of who are you? What are you? Like certain moments when folks in the black community would kind of reach out to me, but I didn't really know what to do with that. Because I didn't personally necessarily feel a kind of connection. But eventually, I started to also feel a certain alienation from the white community that, you know, certain girls' fathers would call me black. And so therefore I couldn't date their daughter. I started getting drawn more and more into conversations of race and starting to have certain assumptions that were made about me. And so I started feeling my body more intently and more intensely over those course of those teenage years. And then finally, when I was 19, I was taking an African-American history course and just started to see the history of race and see the history of both how malleable it is, but also how expansive it was to be black, that it wasn't a kind of narrow way, kind of cultural phenomenon or just a skin color. But it was really it was for folks who had been marked black. It was a way of inhabiting the world, a way of being for one another. And so I had this one moment where I saw a couple of pictures of like Langston Hughes and W.E. Du Bois. And I had this kind of sudden realization. It was almost a conversion, really. That's why I kind of describe it that way, that, oh, these people were me. I mean, they looked like me. They had my skin tone. And then a realization that if this had been 25 years prior, you know, I wouldn't have been at school where I was. My life would have been very different. And then all of a sudden, it makes you kind of flash back to all of those moments when I was younger. And I realized, oh, wait, I really was different. I wasn't the person that I thought I was. And then all of a sudden, you kind of turn then to the black community and start to see the way that they've always been kind of offering, extending that. So part of it is was a recognition of the alienation that I had shared. But it was also a recognition of the community that was being offered to me. As I kind of got deeper into an understanding of the history, as I got more embedded and connected to the black community, I also started to realize that it's also a responsibility, that when I go into a room, my body does a certain amount of work, and that in some ways it wants to be used by some people as a kind of safety, to kind of say, oh, you're a safe Black person. Oh, you're not like those other people. We understand you. But then at other moments, you know, for many, I've had so many students that said, I'm the first Black professor that they've ever had. And so I have a responsibility to show them that it's not just about a body, but it's about a way of doing one's work, a way of being in the world and creating spaces of freedom for others. And so that was a journey that really started when I was 19, almost as a kind of realization of what that means. But again, that's my own real particular story. And I think part of what I've come to realize is, and what I love about the Black community is the multiplicity of ways of multiplicity of what it means to be Black, and that my story is just one kind of corner of that story.
Let me see if I was understanding one part of your book. So the title of it is The Death of Race, and there is on the one hand there was a way that race as this category was a category of death because it allowed for there to be oppression, a labeling, and then a differentiation with some being superior and some being inferior. On the other hand, there was this, I sense this call that out of the death, if race was a category of death, if we were able to see race come to die, that would be a good thing, but not in the way that it would erase our differences, but it would allow our differences to flourish. And so in a sense, there was a resurrection on the other side of this death that really validated the differences of race that are communicated on our bodies. Mm-hmm. So did I read you right? I'm welcome to some correction. And talk to us about the title then, about what does it mean with the death of race, especially if I'm wrong, right? Yeah. If I'm wrong, then tell me, how should we read that? Or did I get you right?
No, I would say for the most part, I mean, when we think about the way that I'm kind of framing race there is to say not so much the particularities of our bodies, the cultural specificity in ways that certain groups kind of share meaning or difference. But what I mean by race is really a system and a way of being that creates self-sufficiency for some by placing others and creating death for others. And so in that way, race is more of a way than a thing. And I think in very ways, it's parasitic on and what it means to be made in the image of God, that being made in the image of God is not a quality or a kind of category of, it's not a category of a human being versus an animal. To be made in the image of God is itself a kind of way. It's a kind of dynamic movement, a singing with who God is in the midst of creation. And so in the same way, an opposing way, race is an oppositional way of being that kind of fragments, right? So it's no longer bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, but it's who I am over against you. And so all of a sudden the power and the freedom that we have can only be sustained through the dehumanizing and consumption of others, such that a world can only be imagined if there are people at the top and people on the bottom, people who are subject and people who are in charge. And so the death of race is to say it's the death of a system of dehumanization, a system that requires life through the death of particular people.
A way of being that is always in conflict.
Yeah.
With winners and with winners and losers.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So at one point I tell a story, I kind of retell the story of the people at the Gerasene and the demoniac, and the ways that the people in the Gerasene, how Gergesa, I think that's right, had created a kind of sense of peace, mm-hmm. right? They're living their lives, they're selling their pigs, they're, you know, all is happy. And yet there's this person who is yelling, screaming, beating themselves, yelling at other folks. And so the only way that they can maintain their peace is to kind of confine him to the tombs. And so to me, like, that's a kind of dynamic of race, mm-hmm. is a way of trying to maintain a certain level of peace through a system of marginalization, through a system of kind of violent differentiation that reduces people to differences and categories.
one of the things I appreciate about the book, especially as you tell your story in it, is it's very humanized, right? And so there's ways that it invites people into it. Like I said, even if there's phrases or paragraphs that I was like, I'm not quite sure what Brian means, but I'm at least aware that I don't know. It was very relational in a way to go through the book. So I really appreciated that. At the same time, you didn't shy away from aspects that would be threatening to people. And I'm having in mind, you've got a picture of the tortured Christ, which is a very threatening picture. I mean, it's off-putting. So you've done relational work, but you've not shied away from threatening work at the same time. And I'm thinking about the people that you just mentioned who had the demoniac, and they shuffled him off, and he had to live in the tombs, and how they were totally threatened whenever he was healed. Right. Yeah. Like his healing threatened them, and it took their livestock away. Right. They had their pigs. So their economy is threatened. When you're writing this book, were there parts of it that you thought this might be more threatening than others to people? You know, what might be some of the threatening things that people might encounter in this book that you think are good for them to be encountered by, not just to be threatened, but because there's life on the other side of wrestling through that?
Yeah. Oh, it's interesting. Well, I think I'm thank you. I'm glad that the relational stories were, that was the work that I was hoping it would do.
There's no footnotes. So I wanted it's part of a series called Theology for the People.
Yeah.
So you're a theologian trying to do theological work in a way that's not for other professional theologians, right? You're trying to do this in a way that's going to be encountering. And so we had, you know, people from all kinds of disciplines who are thoughtful people, but not necessarily educated in theology. So it's got that readability, no footnotes. So, that's relational in itself.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that, but.
Well, yeah, I rewrote it probably three times, and every time coming back with the editors, and it wasn't quite right. And it wasn't until I started actually using some of the stories. Some of the stories are ones that I share oftentimes in my classes teaching undergraduates. Others are stories that I've just included over time. But kind of even coming back to the bookshelf thing, I realized after by the last very end of it that it needed some flesh to it. Mm-hmm. In some ways, I was telling my story as much as I was telling any particular story. But I think what's kind of interesting about the idea of threatening is that I actually didn't think of it as being threatening. There's not any part in particular that I thought like, oh, this is where I'm going to really stick it to people. it was narrating. This is the God that I see. Mm. This is the God that's encountered me. These are the places, this is where God has challenged me. And, you know, and really, and a lot, and quite frankly, just hoping, depending more on the Spirit to do the threatening than anything. In a lot of ways, I think that that's, to me, that that's the power of Jesus's ministry. Like, I don't think he went out to really turn tables, but it was, in fact, the most radical moments of peace, of inclusivity, of recognition that seemed most threatening to people. And I think that says a lot, that sometimes when we're faithful, when we build lives of love, when we choose life and we choose to be with people despite whatever differences, that itself becomes a threatening thing, not because we intend it, but because the system, the systemic kind of sinful structure is built upon the presumption that we don't need those people. And becoming by God coming near, you know, I think this is true, right, of Jesus' own life, that when the word comes near, when God uses those, when Jesus uses those I am statements or forgives people or says before Abraham, I am, right? Something greater than the temple is here. All of a sudden that's threatening because there was this world that presupposed that God was distant, right? And now God's come. And now that means that what we thought God was isn't the case. Who we thought we were is not the case. And that can be scary.
When I was going through this book, I was thinking to myself, I wish I had read this 1 year ago. I just did a class on leadership and giving a theological anthropology, just an introductory one where we looked at people as stories and relationships and bodies. And you've got a great picture of the human body in this. I'm going to read just a little quote. You have this. We are dirt wet with spirit. I am more than just a collection of cells. Who I am is tied to my body. My soul, the way I hope or mourn, what I love are never disconnected from my particular face, the way I experience the world. I am not who I am without this body. Now, I love that phrase. We are dirt wet with spirit. Why did you think that developing a systematic theology that accounts for race needed to have such a discussion on bodies, even poetic language to discuss our bodies? Why did you find that was necessary?
Yeah, well, I think kind of coming back to this idea that, I think in all of our conversations about race or gender or sexuality, I think we have this presupposition of what we think the image of God looks like. And I think oftentimes it gets reduced to a certain intellectual or notion of spirit, maybe even a notion of mind or rationality or capacity to choose in some ways. And in doing so, what it means is that we need a right idea first, and then hopefully our body will follow along, right? Or we need a right idea, but our body wants a wrong idea, and so we have to beat our bodies into submission in some ways. But the question for me was, well, wait a second, if we're made in the image of God, our bodies are inclusive of that image, which means that it's not extraneous, but it's actually made to be part of what it means to live with, to move into God's own life. And then if we look at so many of the kind of aspects of our fallenness, the aspects of our fallenness really are bodily, right? I mean, I think that as much as people want to worry about hell and kind of what happens after we die, there's enough hell here already for lifetimes, right? Whether it's the kind of hell of genocide or mass shooting or rape or murder, or even the hell of a kind of just a profound loneliness, right? Where people have no sense of hope anymore that they want to end their life. I mean, that seems pretty hellish to me. I'm not sure we have to imagine new forms of torture, right? But if that's the case, then, you know, how do we begin to think about what our Christian lives mean as though our bodies were actually good, as though our bodies are actually fundamentally part of what it means to live into this image of God? And I think this gets confirmed ultimately in the incarnation, is that the incarnation is not like a plan B where, oh crap, like they really messed this up. What can we do to clean this up? But what if the incarnation is actually a culmination of what God had already wanted to be, such that our first being made in a flesh and spirit is actually just a foretaste of what was to come? And so I think in a lot of ways we think about racism and sexism, these are all, their fundamental seeds are attempts to somehow distort a notion of our bodied lives, to misuse them, to consume them, to render some of them as more important, to hide aspects of others. But, you know, what happens if we say the kind of particularities and the uniqueness of the ways that we all experience the world? What if that's all part of what it means to follow God? And I think it gives us more opportunities and more ways of imagining what faithfulness can look like than simply certain notions of right doctrine or a list of do's and don'ts.
I want to kind of wrap things up by going back to where we started, which was the sense of building the bookshelves and having something tangible as this kind of concrete counteraction to the ephemeral and the intellectualisms of seminary, which have their place. And we've had an intellectual discussion here, and maybe we have people listening in that are saying, okay, how do I live in a way that brings some of these intersections with other stories and with other bodies in a way that's Christian, that enjoys some of the flourishing that God intended for us, or that doesn't ignore some of the ways that we have developed ways of being that are in conflict. Now, obviously, you and I are participating in this in one way by having a conversation on a podcast, right? This is like having a conversation is a way of doing that. And I want our listeners not to overlook how rich a conversation can be with somebody who's got a different story from you, and to see those different stories in multiple ways, right? Not only race, mm-hmm. but in other ways, economically or geographically, or by gender, right? There's multiple ways we can have conversations. So that's one that you might even want to talk about a little bit more. But if somebody's saying, okay, how can I put this into practice? How can I build a bookshelf? What advice might you have for them? What ideas could you give to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think we actually live in an amazing moment where we have access really to so much information, and some of it can get really overwhelming, and it's hard to parse out and figure out which is which. That's part of the reason why I have a book list in the back of the book for recommended reading. Some of them are a little bit more intense theologically. Some of them are novels. Some of them are collections of essays. But I would say really part of it is to, for folks who are kind of just beginning this journey, is to let yourself be encountered by some people who are different. And in the midst of the discomfort, let the first inclination be, why are they telling the story that they're telling? Why do they start there? What is it that they see in the world? And instead of trying to kind of, in a sense, insulate ourselves and protect us from a certain idea, we all tell these stories because we have encounters, because we have experiences. We're not ideologically driven, right? Mm-hmm. There's something material every day that shapes the reason why people are telling the story. So whether it's through novels, whether it's through essays, whether it's through op-eds, you know, sometimes even following people on Twitter or Instagram is a way of kind of, they're giving you a little window. They're actually being really vulnerable and letting you see a little part of their life. And at that point, you don't need to like interact with them on social media or anything, but just like kind of follow them and see the things that they get upset about, the things that hurt them. I mean, in the midst of the Christchurch attack, you know, that to follow Muslim brothers and sisters and to see the anguish and how that anguish is connected to this long story of their experience of being Muslim in America, what that fear means, I think is a really big part of it. But then beyond that, when hearing other people's stories, is also beginning to see how our stories are tied to their stories, and know whether it's a certain story of whiteness, whether it's a certain story of what it means to be Black. And so I think those are, I can't say enough about that, that you might say, well, reading more books or listening to podcasts or, you know, following a Twitter feed seems a little, it doesn't seem like a lot. But if we're entering into those moments, really wanting to get to know those people's stories, and then starting to ask where does my story intersect in ways that make me uncomfortable? And then you kind of step back and then look around in your neighborhood. It will not take long before you see a budget bill come up in your school district for wanting to make sure that kids don't get bused from that neighborhood down the street. Right. Or it won't be long before there's a bill around, you know, wanting to fund a new jail. Right. Or fund a jail instead of funding a new school. And before you know it, you start to see that, wait a second, I thought these things were really distant from me, but they actually are very much tied to my life. Mm. Who are some of the people that I can start to listen to? How can I start to get involved with that? I think is a huge starting point. And then I think it's also partly a story for people who have felt a sense of marginalization, who are trying to find a different way of telling their own story, or find a different way of telling the story in their churches, where there's multiple layers. And I think that's the last thing I want to kind of leave with, is that while the book is about race, it's also about gender. It's also a little bit, it kind of touches a little bit on issues of sexuality. And the reality is that there's no one group that isn't without its own oppressions, that isn't kind of inflicting, struggling with certain questions. So on one hand, I can understand the marginalization of race. On the other hand, I have to really work with and work against the inclinations towards patriarchy, the inclinations towards misogyny and a kind of toxic masculinity. And so I think that we always have to be looking and attending to the ways that those kind of tendencies to dehumanize or tendencies to protect our way of being sometimes come into conflict with one another. So we all have to confess something, and we all have to learn what it means to live into the life of Christ in more substantive ways.
Yeah, I appreciate, I mean, go back to use the category you used earlier was we develop ways of being in the world that are oppositional, that are in conflict, and to recognize that maybe we do have those, and even ways that we live oppositionally to others without even realizing it, and to avail ourselves of the many ways that we can see and hear and understand people's stories and limited ways that they share with us. You have a great piece of wisdom in the book that has about not presuming that another wants a relationship with you, and so to be wise about, well, if somebody is sharing something on social media, then they might not want a full blown relationship with me, but they're sharing something with me. Mm-hmm. If they produce a song, I might not be able to be personal friends with the artist, but I can hear something that they've shared with me. And I'd encourage listeners that if God's heart is for us to live in harmony with one another, if God's goal for us is to image him in partnership in this world, then see if there are ways that people are looking for a relationship with us, and to lean into those. That maybe there's a person who's been initiating with us, and we haven't thought about them as somebody we can learn from, or as a way that God is initiating a sense of awareness, both of myself and of the other person, and the stories that we are embodying and bringing together. That cup of coffee, that pastoral visit, if they're a pastor, or whatever other opportunity a person has got, that's an opportunity for them to engage in relationship that we might not have to go looking for. It might already be there because God is active in the world doing that, right? His spirit is active. His spirit is active to bring these bodies together, to bring that matter, which is good, together. And so whenever I had that kind of awareness that somebody showed me in pastoral ministry, that you don't always have to be initiating. Sometimes you receive that somebody else has initiated with you, and like, oh my goodness, God is doing something here. Mm-hmm. And I can receive it. That was so helpful for me. So anyways, thank you for that wisdom that you shared, that we shouldn't presume that people are in relationship, are looking for a relationship with us, but to avail ourselves of the way that they have shared themselves with us, and for the reminder that brought to me of maybe God has initiated relationship from somebody else to me that I can receive, and I don't have to be the initiator, but I can receive it. Thanks, Brian, for sharing your story with us in the book. Thanks for sharing your time with us on this podcast. I appreciate your time and the way you've gone about doing so.
Thanks, Aaron. It's been a pleasure.
I hope some of this podcast has resonated with our listeners, and that you'll check out some of our other podcasts. I'd encourage you listening to the podcast with Tammy Ross on Ministry to Special Needs. It's another way of encountering persons with bodies different from our own. And I'd also encourage you to check out the podcast that focused on ministry with the elderly as well, as people were as ways to encounter bodies that are at different life seasons, perhaps from your own, or maybe in a season of life that is what you're going through right now. I think these are ways that this conversation on the death of race can be extended from what we've started today. So check out those podcasts as well. Thanks so much, Brian. Thanks so much, listeners, for tuning in. And we hope you have a great day.
Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the name Wesley Seminary.